Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 66, The Enlightened Patrolman, an interview with Nicole von Germesen. I have a special interview episode for you today with Nicole von Germesen about her new book, The Enlightened Patrolman, Early Law Enforcement in Mexico City. Nicole is a history professor and the Associate Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Oregon State University. She's the author of close to 100 books, essays, reviews and articles, as well as being the recipient of research funding from the Ford Foundation, the Fulbright Program and the American Philosophical Society, amongst others. Her research and writings have focused on the social history of the Spanish Empire, including sex work in Colombia, and the experience of the Afro-Mexican population. The Enlightened Patrolman focuses on a proto-police force in colonial Mexico City and uses primary sources to examine both the day-to-day lives of these men and the larger socio-political ideas behind their work. In the process, it brings the streets of the city to life, providing a fascinating glimpse of what it might have been like to venture out onto the city streets in the Northern Hemisphere's largest city 200 years ago. If you find yourself wanting to know more after listening to the interview, and there are lots of things we didn't have time to cover, the book has recently come out and it's available to order now online. So your book focuses on a specific organization tasked with lighting the streets and maintaining order in Mexico City. Just to get some context, during what time period did they operate? What were their tasks? And what were Mexico City and New Spain like more generally at the time?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So they were officially founded in 1790, and that was shortly after a really horrendous murder case had been so-called solved in late 1789. And it was also the beginning of the term of the really well-known viceroy of New Spain, known as the Count of Revillagigedo. So he showed up in late October of 1789, right when this 11-person murder took place in, right in the center of Mexico City. So immediately the idea was the streets are unsafe, and the focus relating to the recently occurring murder was that there's murders, there's violence, houses are being invaded, valuable objects and money are being stolen. This is an unsafe city. So this is how he reacted so quickly to creating a new force of patrolmen. And so they operated through independence, through insurgency in the early 1800s and well into the 19th century. But later developments of more modern police in the Santa Ana era in the 1830s kind of overtook them. So I just focus on the viceregal period from 1790 to the early 1820s, when they were kind of the only semi-professional patrols in Mexico City. And so, yeah, this was an era of, in the 1790s, really extremes of people's experiences. So while it was one of the wealthiest eras of new Spanish history due to massive mining booms out of Western Mexico, Guanajuato especially, and, you know, more tax collecting, monopolies, all kinds of things that we call the Bourbon reforms, it's also a time of a very large number of natural disasters, dozens of earthquakes, droughts, floods, epidemics, whatnot. So it's kind of an extreme where there was a extremely wealthy, sophisticated European style elite. And then at the other extreme, there was a great deal of poverty, hunger, you know, inflation that others suffered. So it was really extreme. So while the city was very luxurious, you know, it had theaters, high fashion, music, dance, everything that any capital city in Europe would have. And it was, of course, Mexico City was, of course, by far the largest city in North America. So yeah, it was a huge city with all those kind of European luxuries, but also a great deal of poverty could be observed on the streets. You know, there was always, a lot of historians have kind of gravitated toward this idea that, you know, there was nudity on the streets, there were people in rags, there were, you know, animals on the streets, filth, you know, sewerage, rotten food, all this kind of thing. We do need to be careful that those are obviously statements made by the viceroy and by people in that elite class. So, you know, highly critical of this place where they have arrived and they're seeking to improve. So I don't know if I necessarily believe all of those kind of negative, that negative talk, because that's, you know, extremely biased. It really connects to the whole story of the Night Watchman, those ideologies of trying to improve this, you know, savage city. And it's interesting that general tone of life of, you know, extremely wealthy and as well as signs of extreme poverty. This is actually something that's typical when a new law enforcement force is started across, you know, kind of Atlantic history, that, you know, it's perceived at the time as, oh, this is a super dangerous era. But actually, when we look back as historians, if we look really carefully, typically those law enforcement new institutions are created at rather prosperous eras, you know, because if it were really, really terrible, then probably you wouldn't be thinking of, you know, robberies and whatnot. There would be much more serious issues to worry about, invasions, you know, this kind of thing. But yeah, and in regards to their basic tasks, so the first essential task that had been a project in development for a couple of decades since about the mid-18th century was the street lighting. And I talk more about that in depth later, but that was the first task for this group of night watchmen who are known as guardafaroleros, lantern guards, is a specific name for them in Spanish. So that's what they were really referred to as, people who, you know, maintained the street lights. And so this was the first publicly funded street lights in New Spain. So there had been attempts to create other systems for street lighting, but this was the one that kind of stayed relatively effective. And then their other task was, of course, keeping an eye out for, you know, potential robberies, thefts, violence. You know, that's just that concept of, if there's a presence of law enforcement, then maybe there'll be a decrease in crimes. You know, that's sort of a thought to the present day. They also, you know, because the streets were quite dark, they also escorted people involved in what would be their kind of emergency services at the time. So that's very different from now. So it would be midwives, priests, and then the only one that we could probably relate to would be doctors and surgeons. So the night watchman would be called to escort those individuals to cases of, you know, women in labor, people needing last rites, people who were dying. So that was one thing they did. They'd also stay alert for, you know, just kind of open windows, open doors, fires, orphans, you know, children on the street at night. And their hours of work were basically sunset to sunrise. So this was the idea that, you know, if a child is on the street, or if a person who's incapacitated, you know, mentally, physically on the street, they would take them in. So that was sort of like their kind of paternalistic role, kind of the protect and serve role. They had other duties, but those are kind of the main ones that were part of the foundation. And of course, that we'll speak about more in depth later is, of course, all of the issues with drinking and public drunkenness were a big focus for them.
And so the book's title is a play on words. As you said, the patrolman literally walked around carrying and maintaining lanterns. But the impetus for creating them was also based on Enlightenment ideas about how cities and societies should be run. What were these ideas, and why did certain members of the ruling class feel it was so important to light up the streets at night?
Yeah, this is a really interesting concept to me, and it is a lot of fun throughout the book to always have a play on words in terms of light. I mean, there's so many metaphors and puns you can use with light. I was reading a novel recently that had a quote that I thought really summed it up. It's a novel by the recently deceased Peter Straub, the horror novelist, and he just has this quote. He said, this sums up, I think it answered your question. He said, artificial light is a poem to reasonableness. The light bulb casts out demons. It speaks in rhymed couplets. So this is an idea that light, artificial light, is civilization. And so not only in the Spanish-speaking world, but across Europe for about, you know, a century or so, there was a push to light streets at night. And this is an idea that other historians have spoken of, who I cite in my book, the idea of conquering the night. So that what I learned in doing this work is that there's a view from elite ruling classes in this era in the broader Atlantic world that plebeians really control the night, that the night is unconquered. They basically live their lives, have their culture, have activities that are not controllable because of darkness. So darkness hides all of these plebeian activities, not just in this colonial setting that I'm working in Mexico City, where there's also a race and imperialistic emphasis, but just in general. And so for a wealthy person, you could hire a guard, you could have lanterns, you'd have your carriage with lanterns, etc. For middle-class people, you know, you maybe just carry a lantern. But for lower classes, working classes, plebeians, you know, it was just the darkness that was not patrolled by the authorities. So it was kind of your space to do what you want. So this is where we think of it as like a conquest of the night. And more specifically, because, you know, we could trace that all the way back to kind of counter-reformation almost era. But more specifically for, you know, kind of the enlightened absolutists of the late 18th century, including the Spanish, who were very much part of the Enlightenment, although that's a little bit less studied than more Northern Europeans. But of course, they had a very complex, sophisticated, you know, Enlightenment thinking, just like every other European nation in the 18th century. They also thought about their economy, and they had an understanding that their understanding, both in Spain and the New World, was that the lower classes were not working effectively. You know, they were lazy, they were disorganized, all those classist stereotypes. So, you know, going out at night, controlling the streets, vagrancy, alcohol consumption, all that was basically making their population inefficient, you know, as workers. So they couldn't produce for the country, they couldn't produce taxes, you know, tax income. They couldn't produce products that could be sold, you know, in international trade. All those aspects of just basic productivity. The idea was we need to make our population more educated, you know, literally like less savage, and then they'll become more productive workers, so our economy can continue apace. You know, it was this concept that they're lazy and that they're ignorant and they're wasting time, you know, other vice, so-called vices, gambling, whatnot. So that's an aspect of it for the Spanish. Another aspect is a sense that other cities were more beautiful, that were more sophisticated, and light was definitely, street lighting and urban lighting was definitely seen as a sign of urban beautification. And it's a point of pride for Spanish leaders, for Spanish viceroys to say, you know, our city is as beautiful, as populous, as well-lighted as any European city. And the street lighting were definitely connected to that. Again, because anything that had to do with plebeian physicality or kind of cultural practices, you know, at night, being on the street, drinking, et cetera, is seen as just ugliness. You know, it's bodies that the embodiment of the poor is ugly, is ignorant. Whereas if you think of the, you know, sophisticated Enlightenment culture is what they obviously perceived from the elite group as beautiful. So having orderly cities is a sign of beauty, a sign of pride, You know, there's quotes along the lines of, you know, the new viceroy arrives in this incredibly populous and in fact wealthy city, and it should also be a beautiful place. Like, that's part of his reputation as the viceroy, to beautify any given viceroy in the 18th century, to beautify the city that he's arrived in by European standards of the time, you know. And so, of course, that also involves, other than, you know, reforms relating to labor, like I spoke of before, those worries, it also relates to massive street paving projects, aqueducts, you know, drainage, all that kind of thing, parks, even regulations about traffic and signage and all that kind of stuff, address numbers on houses. That sort of idea, that what was interesting for me in doing the research was, you know, all this stuff that we take for granted in a city, a simple thing like address numbers, didn't exist before the sort of mid-18th century. So there were no address numbers. Trash collection, obviously, that's a super vital aspect of making a city livable. Another thing that the Night Watchman did that related to this concept of, you know, enlightenment is, they were the, which I didn't mention before in my last answer, that they were kind of the animal control. So there was a big dog population on the streets of Mexico City. And what they viewed that as, other than the perhaps dangers and whatnot of, you know, rabies, biting, et cetera, they just viewed it as, it made the city seem like the countryside. If you hear barking dogs and cows and roosters crowing and all that in a city, it has a rural feeling. And of course, you know, there's a great distinction between city life and rural life, and that's a, you know, consistent throughout Spanish history, that the city is a place where civilization is, so it shouldn't have this feeling like you're on a ranch, you know. That was part of the Night Watchman's task, to get the dogs off the street. That was a very brutal, violent aspect of their duties, probably the most gruesome for a lot of readers, I think. But the so that's all connected to the idea of the city should be civilized. There's an idea that we need to imitate Europe. That's very much repeated in the decades where they're trying to create this system of public lighting. Like, European cities do this, and European cities have a better judicial system. So that's what we need to do as well. The patrolmen and the lights will help us prevent crime in our city. You know, it's they view it as simply as that if there's people on the streets and the streets aren't dark, we will have safer streets. We will have a more enlightened approach to justice. So there's really almost everything is tied to that concept, light and civilization in the ideology that overarches the foundation of this law enforcement institution. So that's like the ideological, intellectual perspective that, in my mind, is, you know, it's a little bit ironic to say enlightened patrolmen, because obviously the men who worked on the street themselves were not enlightenment thinkers, right? They were just carrying the light, you know, so physically carrying it. So that's kind of it's almost like a question mark. You could say, like, are they enlightened? Are they the enlightened patrolmen? You know, question mark in the title. But it is fun to play on words like that. And I do feel like it really resonates, you know, with that concept. And of course, in Spanish, it's even better, because we have the term for the Enlightenment, siglo de luces, you know, the century of lights. So it's just a very nice symbolic package there all around.
And so to produce the book, you basically examine the paper trail that these patrolmen created, and to a certain extent, their superiors, talking about what they should be doing, what they were doing right and wrong, things like that. But could you go further into what kind of documents you had to go on and how easy it was to find them?
Yeah, that's always a fun question for an archival-based social historian like myself. Historians of my field know about this source called the Libros de Reos, and there was a historian, Michael Scardeville, who studied this for his dissertation way back in the mid to late 1970s. And so that kind of made a lot of us aware over the years that this is a source. He used it to talk about poverty in ideas about the poor in this era of Mexico City. And there's one legal historian called Sanchez Arcia, and he's used it for studying the judiciary. But to my knowledge, no one else has systematically and comprehensively use these records. And so they're called libros de reos. They're basically, that means books of arrested individuals. And about four or so survive right now that I could have access to. Yeah, so they're basically just police dockets, police logbooks. They're very much related to maybe something that exists today, you know, or especially before we had computerization, where, you know, there might have just been a written log of activities each night taken on by law enforcement patrols. Myself and those two other scholars that I mentioned, we've kind of done a statistical analysis. And of course, I worked with what they did, but I also kind of did my own. And it ends up having several thousand names and a few thousand kind of incidents. Now, so that is, so I counted about 3,600 incidents of encounters of, you know, an individual or several individuals interacting with the night patrols. But that is not my only source. I also had what they call the nightly report of the Guarda Mayor. So that's like, to talk in a very modern and anachronistic way, the Guarda Mayor is like the police chief. And so he took a report every night of the approximately 99 patrolmen that were in the street. And he just does a simple log where he's not saying all of their arrests, which is what the Libro de Reos does. It talks about all the arrests, all the people brought in. This is just kind of a summary of what the men are doing each night. So a lot of them just say basically nothing. They patrolled their beat, you know, but other details exist. And this is actually where I found the details regarding the animal control was in the Guarda Mayor reports. And then, so that about, you know, maybe a couple dozen of those exist, especially in the early 1820s, unfortunately, not so much in the earlier period. So that is a report that I've never heard of anyone else using. And it's pretty helpful in terms of kind of plotting their activities across the night and understanding which sub-regions of the city they patrolled, which is a key part of my book, you know, creating that geographic space. And then, of course, I use, like, you know, as you said, the kind of elite documents, so that those other sources are, to me, pure social history. You know, they're just piecing together like three words, you know, repeated across thousands of records. What are these three words, you know, these very scant descriptions? How can we create a story out of that? You know, there's really not a lot there, but when you add up a few thousand of them, you start to see patterns. And that's what I was trying to do, along with the other historians who were seeking other pieces of information to derive from, or conclusions to derive. But yeah, the elite sources, you know, would be things like trying to implement street lighting, you know, just general thoughts, general kind of, in my mind, sort of elite musings. And that's not really the type of source that I gravitate towards in my three decades of being a historian. I really like the smaller sources that don't have just an obvious bias, you know, in a narrative structure, but that are more just bits and pieces. And then also another source that I don't believe has been used too much is when the night watchmen were actually arrested themselves and had more prolonged cases, judicial cases, where they were either witnesses or they were the defendant. So when they got in trouble, when they committed crimes, they would have a case, a judicial case about them, just like any other defendant, any other accused individual. So I tried to go into those to learn a little bit more about who they were, their personalities, because as anyone knows who studies Latin America, the Spanish-speaking world, always there's a decent amount of biographic detail in every, you know, criminal case file. So the only way I could know biographic detail is not through the Libros de Reos, because there's not enough information provided, but through the longer cases where the night watchmen were in trouble. You know, that's how I got biographic detail, because it always says, you know, race, marital status, where the person was born, their age, you know, so that's how I could accumulate some biographic detail, was in these larger cases. So, yeah, so as always, I, you know, previous historians help point us to sources, but we need to, you know, do something different and incorporate more sources. So we're not just, you know, kind of using what they did. And of course, I'm really grateful that other historians have paved the way, those two that I mentioned, because nobody's really written, especially a book length story of these men, I really had to pull in a lot of other things as well, what I've described. And you can get a lot from that. And I know my dissertation advisor from Berkeley, Professor Bill Taylor, who spoke on a previous episode, it was really great to have his kind of support in this book. And he commented, you know, it really takes a lot of imagination and patience to pull these sources together, because it's not like you can go to a file and it's just like, okay, here's all the stuff on the Night Watchman. You know, it's not, that's not in existence. So you have to kind of pull a lot of different stuff together, like most social history topics.
Yeah, that was something I was going to comment on. You really bring the streets and the characters to life throughout the book. You know, individual kind of life stories occasionally of patrolmen, things like that, which I thought was, it made the book really, really easy to read and really enjoyable. I was going to ask, are these sources digitalized or did you have to go somewhere to find them?
Yeah, I was everything for this particular book, every single thing was in the National Archive in Mexico City. So in my other books, I've you know, looked around at different archives, even in Seville and Madrid and what, you know, actually dozens of kind of smaller towns in Mexico. But in this case, I was doing a 100% Mexico City project. So everything was in Mexico City. Some scattered stuff may be digitalized on the archive webpage that people can access. But last time I looked, which hasn't been that recently, because obviously I finished writing the book and doing the research a couple years ago, the Libros de Reyes themselves are not digitized because they're pretty long, you know, and they're, each page would not be that exciting, you know, to the casual viewer. It's bringing it all together. So I was really lucky. I had a number of undergraduates here at Oregon State University who went down with me, and I've been privileged to be allowed to photograph stuff in archives since the 1990s. And that's just thanks to the people who work in those archives who are kind enough to let foreign researchers, you know, take photographs. Ever since we had the ability to do, you know, digital photos, it's really been a lot easier. But I've been taking these photos for decades. And then I had the help of my students because, you know, these are hundreds of pages. So I was able to get some really great undergraduates from my institution to come down with me, and they're doing their own research, you know, studying Spanish, all that, going on to grad school themselves. And so as a step, you know, it was kind of help me take these photos. So that's what they did. And I'm really grateful to them for doing that. So then I was, again, really lucky during the time of all the shutdowns. I had all these photos, like hundreds, if not thousands of photos that I could go through on my laptop in order to write this book and another book I have coming out next year. So I don't think you could do the work online, but you can do it at home if you prep, you know, you prep with getting all those photos, you know, like I said, hundreds, if not thousands of them. And then they're available, you know, I can go back to them or share them with other researchers or what have you.
Right.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
For us today, the idea of the police not existing seems quite strange. It can be quite hard for us to get our heads around how law and justice might have worked. In the book, you point out that the patrolmen were not police quite in the way that we understand them, but perhaps you would say they were a step on the, along the path towards our police. So how were crimes prevented, and how were people who had committed them apprehended and tried in New Spain before these patrolmen were set up, or during the day when they weren't patrolling? And you also mentioned that they had interactions with other groups who had a law enforcement role, such as the military. So how did they interact with groups such as those?
Yeah, the history of, to me, the history of law enforcement is so fascinating, and it's so important to so many countries. So like to talk specifically about Mexico City and then maybe broaden it out a bit. And even we have to go back to Spain. You know, of course, Spain has their own ancient kind of law enforcement. The Santa Hermandad is really famous, which is a kind of highway patrol. If you look up this information, I mean, all of these law enforcement bodies in some form continue through to the present. The key distinction between a traditional patrol, which Mexico City had before these men, before the Guardafueros, is the volunteer aspect of it. Law enforcement across, and again, really what I'm working on is the Atlantic world. I don't have expertise in, say, Asia or Africa or the Middle East or India or whatnot. I can only speak of kind of European-related locations, unfortunately. But law enforcement is volunteer. So it's basically a kind of neighborhood watch with all the shortcomings that you can imagine. And for the Spanish-speaking world, including Mexico City, that was an honorable task. You know, to be the alcalde is a person who's known as an honorable man that you can knock on his door and he'll help you in the night. Or he might have some patrols, of which I'm not clear what kind of like timing they would have. You know, do they patrol all night long? Does he go out once with a group of his pals? I mean, that's a little unclear to me, but they did patrol. There were also military patrols, especially in this late 18th century time period going into insurgency where there's more militarization in Mexico City and Spanish America for various, you know, more global reasons, right? But that's all volunteer. So it's extremely different. And those coexisted, just like in most cities in the Atlantic world, the volunteers coexisted with the movements towards professional law enforcement. So they're obviously conflicting because, like I said, and your question pointed to military has a certain honor affiliated with it, certain privileges for the Spanish speaking world. The alcaldes are men of honor. They're entrusted with this. I guess it's like, I mean, it could be relatable to the British system where you have these kind of, you know, justice of the peace, that's kind of person. So they're more elite people, and the military have their sense of privilege and certain specific privileges. So to them, the night watchmen are just plebeian brutes, you know, and they even make a mockery of them. Like, you have no authority during the daytime. You know, we as alcaldes or as military men, we're still that during the day. But during the day, you're nothing because you're night watchmen, you're guardafueros, you're lantern guards. So there were these coexisting groups. Now you say, how did you police anything before? And there really weren't patrols. Like, to have patrolmen in the streets in the daytime is not typical of history. And this is why we always have to remember that any resistance to law enforcement patrols of any kind is the norm. That is the norm. And that's one of the points of my book, because of course I was writing in this era of anti-police activism in 2020. And I kind of had the incentive, like, to resist law enforcement is the norm. And all historiography will indicate that. So right from the beginning, people are against law enforcement. So to continue your question, how did anything get police? Like, how did people report crimes? They could report them directly to the alcalde or to a court. So they have the system that historians who study this era and this these geographic spaces, the querella, the complaint. So you bring a complaint forward, and that applies to all the numerous courts within the Spanish system, including the Holy Office of the Spanish Inquisition. These are always generated by complaints because they didn't have the policing ability. That's a modern concept. And there's a couple other aspects of modern police that I can't help but to mention because I'm just really interested in it, that, you know, things like a uniform. So the night watchman in Mexico City did not wear a uniform. They carried a chuzo, what we might translate as a pike, just a stick with a sharp end, you know, a metal thing at the end that could be used as a weapon. They carried that. They carried their lantern. Basically, that was their uniform. There's no other uniform. And the reason is because uniforms are military. So the French law enforcement had uniforms. And in this era, French law enforcement was viewed as extremely oppressive spies. You know, that's how other Europeans viewed French law enforcement, you know, Paris police, whatever. They were early. They started really early. So it was seen as a very controlling, authoritative, spy-like entity that other countries didn't want to emulate. And so, of course, we don't have uniforms in, say, London police until 1830. And the choice of uniforms is a big deal because it just gives people, if you had London police in red coats, like the military, I mean, it's just so obvious as a target of resistance. You know, the idea was make it a little more subtle with a blue coat and with the night watchman. They, other than their lantern and their staff, they look like regular plebeians. They're just in a cloak and a hat, boots, you know, plain colored. They don't have a uniform provided. Another aspect of what is modern policing is to have it be, you know, paid a salary. So these men were paid a salary, although typical of the Spanish-speaking world, if they incurred damages, they paid them. So they could end up owing more than they earned, which is not great, of course, right? But they weren't paid like the Bow Street Runners, another British law enforcement institution. They weren't paid by the job, like a bounty hunter. So that's not modern law enforcement, to be kind of paid by the job, you know, so then you're just hired by who has the most money. The Mexico City Night Watchmen did not have that. So they weren't volunteer. They weren't paid by the job. They were paid a salary. Those are all indications of modern law enforcement, modern policing. As I said in my previous answer, they had a kind of a chief, and that chief was connected to city and state government. So the chief was directly supervised by the viceroy. He had a lot of interactions. This is the guarda mayor, the head guard. He had a lot of interactions with the municipal government, the city government, all the different institutions, complex institutions of city government in Mexico City. This is modern, right? Not modern is having a nobleman have an entourage with weapons, which is the norm, you know, throughout European history, right? Those are the people who police the streets. That's why there's so much violence throughout history on city streets. In say early modern or medieval Europe. Yeah, so those are some of the aspects of what is modern policing. It's really about how they're organized as a modern state bureaucracy. So that's why I try to kind of make the assertion that this is one of the more modern police forces, or, you know, proto police forces in the Americas, because while the cities like Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston, New York existed, they were only a few thousand. The population was tiny, and they didn't have this kind of modern structure until kind of mid-19th century almost. But they did have night watchmen, but they were more that typical kind of parish guard that you also hear about for Great Britain, you know. So these guys that I'm studying are kind of an amalgamation of old and new. I think that covers the different parts of the question.
Definitely. It's fascinating.
I think so too.
You don't realize, you just sort of take the police as a given, even if you have problems with the police. It's just very interesting to think about how society was ordered in previous times in a completely different way.
I think about that a lot. I mean, if you study history, you know, if there's no professional law enforcement with all their shortcomings, especially if you study Latin American history, Spanish, Portuguese history, who steps in? The Catholic Church. The other option is kind of this neighborhood watch. I mean, these are all not great options.
Yeah. And when you're talking about feudal, kind of feudal lords, so that doesn't sound very appealing either.
Kind of like Vikings, you know, eye for an eye, sort of vengeance-based justice. Also not ideal.
Yeah. So you talked about how they were quite low paid, the patrolmen, and how they could actually end up losing money if there was damage to the equipment. You also talk about in the book how they would sometimes face physical violence and open hostility from the population of the city. So on the one hand, it seems like a pretty horrible job, and you sort of wonder who would want to do it. But on the other hand, you mentioned earlier about how sometimes they would be arrested themselves, and some of them at least seem to think that there were certain perks that came with the job, which you could describe a lot of the time as abuse of power and position. So what do we know about the people who signed up to do it, and why they chose to do it?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's the one that's a little difficult because as I said earlier, you know, that there's not a lot of details about them in the more numerous records. They're always referred to by number, so they have a number, and that's also an aspect of modernity that they have a badge number in a sense. You know, that strikes me when I figured that out. That struck me as really modern, but the badge number actually relates to their patrol area. So not their identity. So it's even more anonymous as they're sort of non-entities. They're just numbers. So that shows sort of how they were viewed. You know, these are just plebeian men. This is a physical job. It's slightly more dependable than being a day laborer. So my supposition, my assumption is that, and I try to kind of focus on this one character, Bernal, who is a cabo, a corporal of the guard. You know, I kind of think about him in a sort of semi-fictional way that, you know, he came to Mexico City in the 1780s from rural areas that are drought, epidemics, you know, people, it's a horrible situation in any given rural area at this time with natural disasters and economic struggles. So come to Mexico City, what can you do? Well, if you're completely working class, plebeian, rural, poor, you don't have really contacts to go into the church. You certainly don't have the education or status to do a professional job like a notary or a lawyer. Don't have the wherewithal to be an international merchant. That, you know, that requires a Spaniard with global connections. And so really day laborer or servant. And, you know, it's funny, one of the early accounts of the Bow Street Runners that's meant to be written by a Bow Street Runner in the 1830s says the same thing. I don't have the personality to be a servant. I don't want to wear livery. You know, so it's like that people don't want to do that and they don't want to be a day laborer. I mean, that's digging ditches. You know, there's nothing attractive about that. And that's the vast majority of the population, you know, and for women, domestic labor or market selling. So it's not a bad job in that regard. But a great historian who passed away maybe a decade or so ago, Paul Vanderwood, wrote a great book about Mexican law enforcement in the 19th century. And he makes the point that I cite in my book that, you know, the police reflect the culture where they are. And this is something that's been heavily studied in other areas, you know, that police become a symbol of masculinity in a certain kind of exaggerated, almost at times heroic fashion. So the concept in Mexico City, where if you're a plebeian man who's spending time on the streets at night, to not drink pulque, the indigenous, you know, cactus-based fermented drink, it is out of character. You know, this is what people do. So to assume, and this is kind of coming from Paul Vanderwood's book of a while back, that's a classic on Mexican 19th century law enforcement, to assume that these men wouldn't, you know, go into a pulqueria and maybe get a little drunk or tipsy, that would could be completely out of their cultural realm. So they're going to do that. And the idea of abuses on the street, you know, I have a couple of case studies that specifically talk about sexual abuse, assault of one particular woman, Brigida Gomez. You know, this is something that we're aware of in terms of women working on the streets, especially sex workers, to the present day, right? That is a potential abuse situation. Because of everything that I describe in that anecdote, it really brings it to life. You know, these men, their power is only limited to that street encounter. So they don't have, I would argue, similar to law enforcement to this day, they don't have extended power. There's so much competition with courts and judges and other law enforcement officials above their rank, et cetera. The only power and authority they have is in those encounters on the street. So then as now, it should not astonish us that sometimes there's an abuse of power in those moments, because these are heavily conflicted moments. You know, these are people who are seeking a physical job. If others are drinking and partying on the streets, it would be unusual if they didn't as well. There's no record of them having some kind of a standard of behavior that they have to take a vow to carry out, right? Like in more modern law enforcement, even including the bobbies from 1830. Although there are comments that they should, you know, speak more politely and whatnot, there's no standard, you know, and there's no like application vetting process that I'm aware of. So it's just like, okay, we got a guy who's capable of basically staying up all night, maybe. And he's willing to, you know, do this, most likely get beat up himself. Everybody is going to hate him. You know, who's going to do that job? So these are not people who have better options. If they did, they would probably do that. And in fact, virtually all of them were illiterate. There's no indication that any of them could read or write. If you could read or write, that meant a promotion right there to Cabo, like Bernal, the Cabo, the corporal I mentioned, because he could sign his name. So right there, you can see these are not privileged elite people. There are some indications, which to me is fascinating, that some of them were not of Spanish ancestry. There were night watchmen who were labeled as Indio, as indigenous. There were a handful, which is typical of the era, labeled with race labels from this period that indicate African ancestry. That this is really surprising to me, because these men were in some petty way authority figures. They did arrest individuals who called themselves Spaniards, who were individuals who could claim honor. So it's very complex. And I think that that extends to the present day. You know, there's opportunities for abuse, and there's certainly people who perhaps go into the work seeking, you know, a voyeuristic experience, an opportunity to engage in violence, right? An opportunity to kind of be a bully or to, you know, take advantage of women on the street, sexual assault, whatnot. That there's certainly people who might be drawn to that, or it comes out in them more when they have this sense of authority. But, you know, in general, I think they were just plebeian men acting like other plebeian men of their culture. They're really not any different from any other plebeian man in that time and place, you know, in terms of always being ready to fight, you know, having certain ideas about gender and sexuality. You know, these are pretty normal, and enjoying pulque, you know, these are pretty normal characteristics for the time period for a working class man.
So one of the most common issues the patrolmen dealt with was drunkenness. And one of the things I really liked is you went as far as to map out where the pulqueria bars were in a section of Mexico City, and to log where people had passed out on their way home and been discovered by patrolmen. It also seems, I picked up from kind of from the book, that there was this idea that the drunkenness problem, in quotation marks, was related to the indigenousness of the population. I imagine in many European cities at the time, public drunkenness would have been a big problem. It still is today, I'd say, in a lot, especially in Northern Europe. So how much of a problem was it? And why did the authorities seem to link it to the indigenous population?
Yeah, this connects, and I'll answer kind of briefly. Although it's a huge and great topic that, again, my advisor, Professor Bill Taylor, also studied in the 70s. So I am very inspired by him. But this is a great topic, a huge topic. And it generally, I think my opinion and the opinion of most historians, anyone I can imagine, it relates to this idea of imperialism and a sense of, you know, you have this savage, barbaric group that you need to impose civilization on. So I truly think it's as simple as that. What I want to do is be sure that I'm not making those same presumptions. And so I think you make a good point that, you know, we can, all of us can read about or know about, you know, gin in 18th century London. Like, this is very well known. So it's no different. We're just in an imperial situation where where caste and class, what we would call race, are very important. So Spaniards also drank. Spaniards were also arrested for severe intoxication. But there was a greater percentage of indigenous people arrested, perhaps because they were the people who would be drinking in more public places, in more plebeian settings. You know, pulquerias are indigenous. That's an indigenous drink. It's an indigenous social setting in Mexico City that only continues to grow for the next 100 years. It doesn't even reach its peak for another 100 years. So it's totally not suppressed by the night watchman or any other governmental action. It completely flourishes for at least another century until beer comes around, right? And to briefly answer your last question, I mean, I think that, like I said at the beginning, these were streets that were run by the poor and working classes. So perceptions of danger are similar to today. It's about that perception of difference. I don't think it was especially more or less dangerous than any other city. It's just like, oh my goodness, these people are different. They're uncivilized. They're not relatable, you know, and I really want to emphasize that there's so much subtlety in studying the drinking patterns that, and I appreciate you mentioning that, you know, we can really see the subtleties of drunkenness that were perceived, the locations, the patterns of drinking, all of that can be revealed in these records if you study them correctly. So that was a goal of mine, to really recreate the nightlife. What would it be to party in Mexico City in the 1790s? So that's definitely something that I'm trying to do for readers and there, but I really encourage people to read if they're, you know, if they want to, like you said, if they want to come to Mexico City, take a little bit of a time machine, feel what it would be like to party on those streets in the 1790s. I really welcome listeners to look at the book, and hopefully you'll get to kind of feel that feeling.
Excellent. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by Max Sargent. For more information, visit the website www.maxsargent.com/thehistoryoflatinamerica. And that's spelt MaxSergeant. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to get in contact at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com. You can also find the Facebook page by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. The Twitter handle is @HistoryLatinAM. And if you've liked the show, you can help out by leaving a review on iTunes. Alternatively, if you visit the website, you'll see that each episode is accompanied by relevant photos. Most of these are my own, taken during my time in Latin America. All these photos and more are available to purchase as prints at my Etsy shop. You can find this at www.etsy.com/maxsargentphoto. That's spelt www.etsy.com/maxsergeant photo. Thanks for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.